So thanks to all of you for coming tonight. We have a sort of enormous PowerPoint presentation with about 100 images, but this is structured as a conversation, so you'll have to bear with us as if we take a moment to kind of find the relevant image to put up on screen, and we hope to allow enough time for you all to ask questions as well.
In fact, you're going to have to scream shut up if we're going on too long, because I think the questions are very important.
So absolutely.
I'm now going to officially take off my watch so that I can see when we've got to shut up.
Sounds good. So,
Venice Biennale.
Exactly. How do you make sense of it?
How do you make sense of it? Well, I guess the question, I'll throw that back at you. Can one ever make sense of a show with 100 artists? I've seen now, I don't know, probably 15 of these giant shows, and I'm just not convinced that sense can be made or sense can be put into it. I imagine that the curators who organize these things do, in fact, see sense in them. The question is, can you communicate that sense? Or will they always be basically a buffet that people come to and finding things they like or things they don't like?
Yeah. Well, that's an interesting question. And, you know, I think it probably depends on which audiences are coming through the exhibition, what kind of sense is made out of each of these shows. I mean, I have to say, and I think that maybe we have a little bit of a different reaction on this level, that for me, walking through the group exhibition at the Biennale, the show organized by Daniel Birnbaum, entitled Making Worlds, for me, his thesis as a curator, this idea of putting a whole bunch of artists together who are interested in sort of making their own worlds, was actually the thing I took away from the show rather than sort of impressions of individual artists' work. So for me, I kind of did think that his thesis made sense and that one could come away from the exhibition with sort of this understanding of a particular, say, moment in the art world where artists are actually not necessarily engaging with the world around them, but making sort of private worlds for themselves.
I guess my problem with that thesis was I couldn't imagine a single work of art that I couldn't describe as making a world for itself. So I suddenly realized if I was curating with that premise, there wasn't a single work that I couldn't include. And I think you could easily imagine some of the works in the show as contradicting each other. Mm-hmm. But I don't know about you, but my overall impression of the show, and maybe we can talk about this afterwards, is that it was surprisingly good in one sense. That is, I had very few revulsion moments, which I'm used to in these kind of shows, right? There was surprisingly little work where you thought, or where I thought anyways, I can't believe he included that artist.
Yeah.
But there were almost no moments where I thought, wow, am I glad I saw that. That has changed my whole notion about what art is like. It felt to me like exactly the show I would have curated, which is surely a bad sign, right? any show that one can imagine a critic having curated has got to be something wrong. Did you have generally the same impression?
I did. I mean, I felt, as I said, I mean, I felt that for me, the thesis was stronger than the individual artist, and there weren't that many revelations. But, I mean, maybe before we get too negative, we should talk about some of the revelations that there
were. Yeah. Oh, there was lots and lots of good art. I mean, that was, again, more than usual. Where should
we
start?
Well, I think we should start in, maybe start in the
now,
past. Unless you see something
past,
that you...
Well, let's... Oh, no, that's a lousy word. Well, should we start with Simon Starling?
Yes, actually, that is what I wanted to start with, because we both like this piece by Simon Starling. And here's another image of it.
No, I'm the guy who's supposed to be really good at describing work in words, which is why I'm going to let you do this.
Oh, great. Well, okay, for me, this was... In some ways, there are two parts to this piece. And what you're seeing sort of closest to the surface of the image, if you will, the sculptural piece is actually a film projector. And those vertical elements are, you know, it's the film looping through these spiraling horizontal metal prongs, if you will.
Sort of the most deluxe film looper that any insane artist has ever even conceived of.
Yeah. And, you know, then the second part of this is the projection itself, which I found far less interesting than the structure of the projector.
I thought the two married perfectly, because the projection is of the place where this apparatus was built, which is also the place that built, I gather, the prototypes for Bauhaus furniture, all sorts of artistic objects. It's a fabricator in Berlin, I think.
I think that's right.
So there's this amazingly weird thing where what you're watching on the screen is partly them building this machine that then allows the projector to operate.
But Blake, did you find the images in the film, the sort of the shots of the film, compelling?
Well,
on a visual level, or is it the content that sort of interested you?
I mean, one of the dangers and glories of doing what we do is it's easy to get jaded, and I'm sort of inhabiting the state of jadedness these days. So I really enjoy having images where visual compellingness doesn't seem to be the issue, where I can sort of get beyond that notion and just pay attention to the content, if you like. There were some brilliant things. The cutting of the film was very closely tied to the sound. So when there was a big, heavy noise of a piece of metal hitting the floor, that would trigger a cut. Mm-hmm. It wasn't always that way, but often enough that it was something I'd never seen before, where the soundtrack was governing the cutting of the film. I thought that was almost an Omar Fast kind of moment.
Yeah, interesting point.
But I thought the package was pretty... I think without the film, I think the piece would have been formalist and maybe a little cute, but
could you
have argued for it without the film?
No, I mean, I definitely wanted the whole thing to be functional. I mean, that's part of the sort of... delightfulness of this piece and sort of what entrances you about the piece is that it's a working projector. On the other hand, it's just that for me, the film itself sort of wasn't as visually compelling as the structure that was showing it. And so it didn't completely add up.
So
but
you wanted the film to be more...
More compelling,
filming.
Yeah.
I mean, one of the things that's sort of nice about it is that there's this weird... It's a film that doesn't achieve the goals of gorgeous formalist modernism, that's set in a place that was all about achieving those goals, which is about the building of an object that is all about those goals for a larger artwork that's obviously criticizing, critiquing those goals. So I thought there was a really nice play of mirrors there.
Yeah.
I thought this was one of the strongest pieces in the whole Venice Biennale.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I think Simon Starling is probably one of the strongest young artists out there practicing today.
And so. Interestingly, does all sorts of different work. So is it two thumbs up?
Absolutely. All right, so we just talked about someone who was very young.
Well, should we go back?
I mean, do
should
we want to go
mean?
Back?
Should we be mean?
Well, no, I want to talk about another positive work,
okay.
Another positive moment. Okay, well, we'll do something mean after this, okay? But I think we both liked this installation of work by the Japanese artists known as the Gotai artists, who were operating principally in the 50s and then into the 60s.
Like as early as, I think 53 is the earliest object, which for this kind of, it's hard to see here, of course, but very conceptual work, you can't believe the dates on it. Especially because we always imagine that the West discovers and the rest of the world borrows, but in fact there's tons of this Gotai work is way earlier than the stuff that we imagine happening in New York and so on.
So, I mean, something that was exciting about it for me was sort of this, if you will, early look at interactivity and artwork. What you have, sort of the upper image is a sculpture that can be walked on, and the lower image is a sculpture that can be listened to, although whether there's actually anything to hear is a question.
I actually missed that work altogether. I thought it was a great and awesome sculpture. Not hear or even see the work to be listened to.
Well, this is one of the benefits of going a little bit after the fact. I sort of went after the preview days when things had quieted down a little bit. And what you can see this woman doing, there's a little white circle on this box, and you were sort of directed to put your ear to the circle and listen. You didn't hear anything necessarily coming from the box, but you heard everything that was around you. And you also had this incredibly intimate moment with the sculpture. I mean, it's you know, it's incredibly physical, sort of wrapping your body around the structure.
One of the things I loved about this installation, oh ye curators, is that most of the objects in it were not the original objects, were not vintage objects. They were almost all recreations. So it felt to me that I was seeing the works as they were meant to be seen, not as they've deteriorated over the years. And I actually think that's a really interesting principle that certainly some curators and museums are interested in. But I think it makes way more sense to see those pink cubes that you can walk on. They're actually sprung, not cubes, squares. You can walk on them, they're sprung. To see them with half disintegrated pink paint wouldn't have meant anything, I think.
Right, and you couldn't have walked on them if it was, it would have that preciousness of an object rather than an experience.
It was all at the freshness. I mean, should we go back one?
Sure.
Even, you can just see in the background, that destroyed paper piece is also a recreation. What's it called? Six holes or something.
Yeah.
And also that is the kind of freshness of someone just having smashed the paper, so there's a performance involved. Had it been old, crumbling, acid, you know, destroyed paper, it wouldn't be the same at all.
But not...
Sorry.
Oh.
Your turn.
Okay. Well, I was going to sort of... I mean, you've directed a point at curators, and I would like to direct a point at curators as well.
I thought I was going to be critical.
No. One thing I did take exception with in terms of this installation is it was sort of the only moment, unless I'm forgetting something, in Birnbaum's show where he kind of represented a group rather individual than individual artists. So I wonder if that was sort of, in some ways, while he was shining some light on Gutai, was he also marginalizing it and saying, you know, there was no one artist that I really wanted to follow through in as comprehensive way as I followed through with some of the other artists in the show?
It's almost the kind of primitivism or colonialism, right?
Yeah.
They just represent this other that's just generally the Gutai group. Because they weren't a collective, after all. They were no more a group than Fluxus or any of those other groups.
Yeah.
Maybe less so, maybe. The other thing that this brought up for me, and this I've seen at a bunch of shows, as you have too, these giant shows, is this retrospective tendency, always including a bunch of artists from the fairly distant past in these big shows, which traditionally have been about contemporary art.
Right.
And one of the great and also shocking things is how well at least this older art that's been chosen, because it has been chosen for this reason, stands up and feels like the contemporary art that's there.
Absolutely, absolutely, and I think these images sort of go to that point. I get all mixed up about left and right when I'm sitting up here, but anyway, the Gutai image of these sort of pinkish paint cans, it's a work from the 1950s, really just struck a strong chord with a very new work, a work that was developed for the space of the exhibition by the artist duo Guyton Walker, who kind of incorporate paint cans into their almost three-dimensional paintings in space. And, you know, again, was Birnbaum sort of deliberately kind of choosing works by Gutai artists that kind of set up some of his premises in terms of more recent art? I'm not sure.
And what does that make us think about Guyton Walker?
Yeah.
This is a misplayed out at Documenta, too, 2 years ago. Where we had the same set of issues. If these older artists are so good, is there a problem with contemporary art?
Right.
I must say, with Guyton Walker, I'd seen their work and this particular kind of work of theirs before in commercial context. Oh, there's a great, great picture here. And I hadn't thought all that highly of it, but for some reason, partly because of where it was situated, it was the first thing you saw when you went into the main, they're now called the Biennale Pavilion, at the Venice Biennale. For some reason it resonated. One reason it resonated for me was that it had an opacity that very few of the works had. That is, it's hard to get. It's very hard to summarize why you might, or for that matter, might not be interested in this work.
Yeah.
I don't mean to flatter it unduly, but there's that Cézanne quality of wondering what's going on in this that was not present in even some of my favorite works from the rest of the Biennale. You know, as I said in the piece I wrote, they were kind of one-liners. This, there was no easy line on it, which made me interested in it already.
Yeah. I mean, I think that, you know, this is sort of a window into process. I mean, as you're walking through this and trying to figure it out, it's almost as if you're sort of sympathetic with the artists and their efforts to kind of figure out what their art is and to solve those kind of creative problems. So.
You know what I particularly liked, and I hadn't seen this in their work before, but maybe they've used it, I just didn't see it, is these structures, these strange lifts of one kind or another that are like you can imagine they're like sort of drafting boards for giant draftsmen or something. They're these really complicated bits of machinery whose only function in this show, at least, is to hoist a picture in the air. And there was something mechanical and strange that got away from just sort of your standard agglomerative sculpture.
Yeah.
Something about having that machinery there that I thought made it more interesting.
And interesting in relationship to the Simon Starling.
Yeah.
And the, you know, this idea of not technology and not sort of the forefront of what machines can do in our society, but kind of looking back to simple mechanics and, you know, how they interrelate with the art world.
And the mechanics of display, especially. The mechanics of display becoming part of the display. It's not a radical new idea, but it seemed really well realized here.
And, you know, talking about this piece, I mean, it was certainly a piece that you kind of had to make your way through, not a, a sort of structured maze, but definitely some sort of a space with obstacles. And it really, in a way, contrasts for me but with this very kind of resolved and polished installation by a young Argentinian artist named Tomas Sarceno, which was also a sort of a space-filling installation that people had to walk around, but it was much, I don't know, much more finished, much more...
superficial.
Oh, I wasn't going to say that. I think I was just going to say attractive.
Attractive, definitely. Yeah. I don't really distinguish too much between attractive and trite superficial. Yeah, I mean, I was troubled by that piece. I was disappointed. I mean, you maybe liked it a little bit better, maybe much better than I do, but I was disappointed. I thought most of Birnbaum's choices felt substantial. There were very few where I thought, oh, that's really facile. This, as you can see, people just liked playing on it like a jungle gym, running through it and under it. It really seemed like a very sort of decorative, easy piece to put in. And I thought, how could someone who put some of these other pieces, including the Gordon Matta's wonderful tree dance, is that what it's called?
Yeah, I think that is what
Gordon
it's called.
Gordon Matta-Clark piece from the 60s. How could he have both pieces?
Well, because they look good next to each other. I mean, I think that's where this idea of the thesis sort of... maybe being stronger than the artworks themselves in some instances. I mean, you know, in relationship to the Gordon Matta-Clark, which, you know, this video of people essentially inhabiting a tree and sort of building structures within the tree and, you know, these interconnecting worlds of the tree and man-made architecture, even though it was very provisional, really resonated for me visually with the Sarceno installation, even though the installation didn't really have the same things to offer as the Gordon Matta-Clark.
But isn't that like a huge pitfall for curating? These two things look the same, let's put them near each other?
Well, unless one allows a person to access the other or to experience the other in a different way. I mean, the Sarceno was very popular in the show. I mean, it was just filled with people. People took delight in this artwork.
Populist.
Absolutely. And I do wonder if by sort of, it depends on what route you followed through the building, but potentially you might come to this before you came to the Gordon Matta-Clark. And would it set some sort of precedent or some idea that would make a person more open to what Matta-Clark was exploring? I mean,
here's a real question for you, and I don't have an answer for you, but I have a kind of suggestion. I think something that can happen with curating, and criticism for that matter, is you guys spend weeks, months looking at the arrangements in your shows. I spend hours, if I'm lucky, 10 hours maximum, say. And I think we see echoes, we see relationships, and invest hugely in them. I'm not sure that 99.5% of the people who come in actually ever make those connections or know to. It's a kind of sophisticated position to know that what you're supposed to do in a show is figure out the curatorial strategy. I've got a feeling that a huge number of people, when it comes down to using shows, treat them just as congeries of separate objects.
So by the same argument or same logic, you know, one might then say, if people aren't really thinking and engaging in the show or the idea behind the show, then why don't we just sort of give them what they like and give them the superficial, attractive artwork that I know.
Well, no, because it's not about giving them what they want. It's giving them what, in fact, can register.
I know, but if they're bored by something and walk by it, you know, in 10 seconds flat, yeah, but they spend, you know, 10 minutes getting tangled in a piece like this, what's the more meaningful encounter?
Let's look at another slide.
Okay, well, you said you wanted to be mean. Can we be meaner than this?
Oh, yeah, we could be, but let's not be. Let's go on to something else. We could talk briefly about the Italian Pavilion. For those of you who've been there before, this could be sort of interesting, an interesting factoid. What used to be called the Italian Pavilion, which is a big building at the back of the Giardini, of the gardens, hasn't been the Italian Pavilion for many, many, many years. It's been the place where the curator, the director of the exhibition, of the whole event, has done a group show. I don't know when it stopped being the Italian Pavilion, but it's been decades. This year, that building is no longer called the Italian Pavilion because that was causing such confusion. So to make things simpler, they stopped calling the Italian Pavilion the Italian Pavilion. They're not calling it the Biennale Pavilion. And what's now the Italian Pavilion is what was formerly something else, and it's now called the Italian Pavilion, except that everyone calls the old Italian Pavilion the Italian Pavilion, so they spend all their time talking about the new Italian Pavilion as something else.
Yeah.
No one, and the truth, the reason no one's talking about the new Italian Pavilion is it was by far the low point in the show. It was the pavilion that people went into and started laughing hysterically.
Yeah.
It was that bad. It was, dare I say it, automatic bad.
Oh, that's not nice. That's not nice.
Considering it was an event, considering the context, I don't think that's entirely.
Well, distraction there. This is the Italian Pavilion that's been renamed the Palazzo della Esposizione.
Oh, that's right. It's not even called the Biennale Pavilion, even though it says in huge letters Biennale on top of it.
Yeah.
It's actually called the Exhibition
Palace
Building. Which is really clear. But anyway, so that what you used to call the Italian Pavilion is now called the Exhibition Palace Pavilion Building. And the reason I, other than just to get a cheap laugh, the reason I brought up the Italian Pavilion is it is a kind of salutary lesson in the fact that it's not as easy to make, I mean, there was tons of really more than adequate, really quite solid art in this exhibition. And it makes you think, oh, well, these days everyone knows how to do it, it's a recipe, you know, the problem with this show is it's all good but not great. And then you go to the Italian Pavilion and you suddenly say, oh my God, there are at least 40 artists on this planet of some note who actually have no idea how to make even mediocre contemporary art. And that actually is a really important lesson. I mean, it shows you how limited, in fact, the vocabulary of contemporary art is, and how it is actually more difficult to achieve than we think. Maybe.
Okay, well, here's the sort of kinder, gentler version of what you've just said. Interestingly, an artist that we showed in realism, named Francesco Vesali, was one of the artists in the Italian Pavilion in 2007. Not this Italian Pavilion, but the one that you're talking about, the one that you're critiquing,
representing Italy. That's right.
So, and I thought it was an interesting piece that he had. And that sort of just points to the fact that there are different people making the selections every 2 years in many instances, although not with the German Pavilion, and we should talk about that before we're through. But, and that these different people who are the commissioners of these pavilions, obviously they allow us to see different slices of the art world. And that art happens in many different ways, in many different places, on many different levels. And, you know, I think what Birnbaum's show does is it sort of taps into a very particular discourse of contemporary art. It's the discourse that the Hirshhorn belongs to. It's the discourse that you belong to. But this Italian Pavilion exhibition, you know, is talking about something different,
discourse.
A different discourse. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Absolutely. But that's a tricky, of course, as I mean, we were talking about this has all been rehearsed. We were talking about this just a few minutes ago. If you say that, then of course, if they're all just equally valid discourses, then it's very hard for you to do your job. It's easier for me because my job is to say this is good or this is bad.
Yeah.
If you really buy into that model, then what do you put in the Hirshhorn and what do you exclude? If it's a purely visual studies model where everything that humans do visually is interesting, makes life complicated.
Makes life complicated, except that, you know, the institution hires the people that it wants to sort of, you know, perpetuate its vision, and the curators that are currently on staff here, or, you know, Birnbaum being selected to do this show, are chosen because they will then make choices that keep that discourse healthy.
That's right, it's a conspiracy. Let's talk about the Venice Biennale. What else?
Should we talk about Germany? You want to talk about that?
Let's talk about Germany.
Okay, I have to find. There's a little preview of Germany. There's the cat, but where is the pavilion itself? Say something amusing.
Oh, say something. Oh, I don't know how to do that. Let me give a little preview to the German pavilion. I might as well talk it through while you're doing that. The weird thing about the German pavilion, I liked it fine, I didn't love it, is that the artist representing Germany this year is, of course, an Irish artist, with not particularly strong connections to Germany, in fact. Liam Gillick. And it's actually pretty daring of them. I'm actually sort of proud of them for saying, no, forget this national BS. We're just going to show the best art we can. And there was a sense in this whole Biennale that the old nationalist, essentialist even, notions were really out the window. There were artists, I mean, Lucas Samaras represented Greece. Yes, of course he's Greek, but he's been living in New York forever and ever. He's essentially a New York artist. There were other examples of that too. The Canadian Pavilion. The guy I wrote about.
Mark Lewis.
Mark Lewis has been living in London for years and years and years. And it just, Germany was the only pavilion brave enough to say, let's just forget about the German thing altogether and let's just make an artist who maybe can address the German condition but doesn't have to be have German blood.
And what's interesting about this, you know, give the curators a pat on the back, is that Germany actually selects a curator rather than selects an artist. So the curator is selected and then can put really anything that he or she wants to in the pavilion.
No, they've never had a non-German before.
I don't know over the course of the history, but the curator is picked for two biennales in a row. So Niklas Schaffhausen from Rotterdam, actually, is where he's based right now, did the Isa Genskin show in 2007 and then did this project with Liam Gillick this year.
Of course, you could say the building was designed under the Nazis by a Nazi architect. And you could say that more than anyone else, the Germans need to have a non-German, need to demolish the notion of nationalist essentialism, ethnic essentialism, as part of the project of having this. I mean, they didn't actually say that, I don't think. That wasn't made explicit, but it did seem to me, since the piece is about modernism, and it's clearly about the pavilion in a big way, you have to figure that's a subtext.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting way to look at this piece, which, you know, I guess if we are, then the cat is sort of the head fascist. I mean, maybe we need to tell those people who didn't actually experience the piece what you see and hear when you walk in. I'll give it a try. So these pictures kind of only give you half the story. But when you walk into the pavilion, you are confronted with these plywood boxes that sort of evoke kitchen cabinets. And they fill the several spaces of this pavilion. So they go through doorways, and again, it's one of those instances where the space is obstructed. You walk around through this maze, and
on steroids is the overwhelming feeling.
Yeah, very, very well put. And kind of like the magnetic center of the piece, at least when I was there, that the thing that everyone with their cameras just clustered around was this cat, this sort of stuffed cat, sitting atop one of the cupboards. And every so often, a very sort of imposing male voice, ostensibly coming from the cat, spoke cryptic words into the space. So you make sense of it.
Well, that's why I didn't spend very long. That's why I wanted you to describe it, because I said, it's IKEA on steroids with a cryptic cat. I thought it was a little stylish, which is a term that always worries me. It was slick. It looked really good. I actually really wanted these cupboards for my kitchen. We have a lovely kitchen. And my first thought was, I'd have to seal them, but I'd love to have a kitchen, A, as big as the German pavilion, and B, with this really quite elegant setting in it. What did you make of the cat?
Well, I read a little bit about it. Ah. That helped me.
Yeah.
because just sort of experiencing it firsthand, it was kind of an eye roller for me, to be completely honest. Again, you know, there wasn't anything to, I mean, you know, if you want those cabinets, you can have them, because they weren't really visually compelling to me. It felt a little bit sterile, and the cat was just sort of odd, you know. So, you know, what we're meant to understand when you read the text associated with this piece is that Gillick, sort of working on his project, set up a provisional studio in his kitchen, and he was kind of meditating on certain questions of authorship and the creative process, all the while his child's cat was disrupting him. And so,
he killed it and stuffed it.
Exactly.
Don't mess with art.
You know, so I, in a sense, it's maybe sort of a study of frustration, or again, you know, in this issue of tackling sort of the artist confronting, you know, an issue, or confronting the big question of finding meaning in their work and being inspired and being able to create. But it was just a little self-indulgent.
Yeah, I mean, I'm really in favor of artists saying, I've just decided this would be a good move. I'm tough shit, I don't know why, and you'll just either take it or leave it. I think that's a really important artistic move, but sometimes you're going to leave it. Sometimes it won't lead to anything at all. And I think this is a case of admiring the gesture without admiring the product of the gesture.
Yeah.
Why don't we pull out just for a second, because I don't want to miss this.
Yeah.
Talk a little bit, because some of the people here may be planning to go to Venice, or may have always thought of going to Venice. Let's talk just for a minute, let's do some service journalism.
Okay.
And talk about what it is to go, and what are your tips for doing the Venice Biennale, because I find it a very problematic experience, really hard.
Yeah, yeah, it's very intimidating. Depends if you're a repeat visitor, if this is your first visit. But my first suggestion would be, you know, I think your priority should be the group show, the sort of signature show that's at Venice every year, this time curated by Daniel Birnbaum. And that's split between two locations, the Giardini, this pavilion that keeps changing its name, and the Arsenale. When you buy a ticket, you can use that ticket at both spaces sort of over the course of time. So I suggest you split those two spaces up over 2 days and just spend a lot of time in each, and, you know, then possibly actually kind of balance that experience with something that offers a little bit different visual art experience than simply contemporary. So, for instance, there's a group show at the Palazzo Fortuny that's integrated in with sort of the textiles and artifacts in that palazzo. It's a good thing to do on the same day you see the Arsenale.
Or even some Titian.
Absolutely.
Some Palladio.
Canova.
Yeah. They all look pretty good. They're not bad.
Yeah. Yeah. And those museums, the Venetian museums, are open until 7:15. The Arsenale and the Giardini close at 6, so you have some time before dinner to see something more traditional.
I actually sort of disagree with you profoundly about the essentials here.
Really?
For some reason, I've always found, I mean, I like the group shows fine. Maybe it's because I'm not a curator, so the curatorial issues don't grab me as hard. I love going from pavilion to pavilion. And because there's isolated experiences, usually of one or maybe two or three artists, I find that really rewarding, because I can sort of close off everything else. There's some pavilions, the Egyptian pavilion this year was terrible. So you just go in, you spend 30 seconds, and you're out. Others you end up spending a long, long time in. And I find, A, that switches up the pace, whereas being immersed in one curatorial vision, I find more fatiguing.
Mm-hmm.
I was there, I think we spent a total of 5 or 6 solid days just looking, and it wasn't nearly enough. There is no length of time that isn't too little for the Venice Biennale, and I really think it's worth spending. I would say, if you can, rent an apartment. Apartments are cheap in Venice. I think 10 days is what it takes to really get the, really sink your teeth in to the show, and figure it out, and go back to things. And, I mean, there are, so there's the Giardini, which is a huge fairgrounds. There's the Arsenale, which keeps increasing in size. It must be several hundred thousand, if not half a million square feet now. Then there are exhibitions scattered throughout, pavilions scattered throughout all of Venice. I worked harder than I've ever worked to see as much as possible.
Yeah.
And I don't think I saw more than 2/3 of the total. There's a question.
Can you give us a visual walkthrough, maybe 5 minutes, and just answer the question, you know, what's the impact of this Venice show historically? Does it really impact the art world, or is it just a curated vision of where you think the art world is going? So far, it's been really sterile from my point of view, in terms of, you know, I'd like to see more.
Just more images? Do you want to just walk through a bunch of images?
Okay,
sure. That's a very good idea. Thank you. I mean, it was. You probably, I mean, depending on your taste, I like sterility, so I was really excited by all the sterility. But it was a cold show. It definitely was a controlled, yeah, you should see my place. It's got like concrete floors and as little on them as possible.
Let's start out.
This is my ideal loft right there.
So this is the empty Arsenale, just to give you a sense of these buildings that we're talking about.
Beautiful medieval industrial buildings, of which few exist in the world. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is where the Venetians made their famous galleys to conquer the Mediterranean. Huge, huge spaces. This is a lovely piece by Licia Pape, the great artist of the 60s mostly, but it's a fairly recent piece. She died pretty recently. This doesn't do it justice. It's this magical beams of thread, in fact, brass thread, that thread through the first space you get into.
And, I mean, just to talk about, you know, this, to speak to your question about how does the Venice Biennale impact the art world, I mean, you know, Licia Pape is someone I think that many curators have sort of, and scholars and historians have been kind of interested in, but no one's really done a major show of Licia Pape recently. You know, by so many people sort of that participate in this discourse that we were kind of talking about earlier, seeing Licia Pape and seeing a work that really, I think, made a strong visual impression in the show, you know, I think that she will kind of rise to the surface and, you know, get more attention. This is one you wrote about.
I'm enjoying the laser pointer. This is a little suburban house transplanted from the United States and just plonked in the middle of the lagoon at the Arsenale. It's a really weird, surreal moment, and I almost prefer it as a moment where someone doesn't know it's art, and a lot of people don't realize this, but you could actually, it was perfectly lined up for the oceanside gate of the Arsenale. So when you went by that far side of Venice in a boat, you suddenly saw this ancient, you know, structures with this suburban house in the middle of it, which I thought was really nice. Maybe a one-liner, but one of the work.
Okay, now you actually wrote on your list that you shared with me that you really loved this piece, and I actually really love this piece. So you go ahead and talk first about this work.
Oh, I really love is way too strong, but all it is a swamp transplanted into the middle of this manicured garden in the very, very back corner. Most people would ignore it. The stench was terrible, but there was just something really strange and poignant, and there was a kind of aggression that I enjoyed in it. I wouldn't go to bat for it in a big way, but it did catch my eye.
Yeah, aggression is right. I mean, after a night of chasing mosquitoes out of my hotel room, this felt very, very threatening.
Need is
very
more
threatening.
In Venice,
yeah.
Right? Another attitude for mosquitoes.
And this work you kind of encountered as you walked through this garden area behind the Arsenale, and at first glance, when came up from it at enough distance that it looked actually organic, but as you moved closer to the structure, it clearly was artificial. And as you moved closer still, it started to jiggle, just like a great big fat human being.
It's funny, I didn't look at it as long as. I know I looked at it, but I didn't notice the jiggling.
Yeah, the jiggling was pretty amazing. So it was, you know, again, we were talking about one-liners in a way, and this too was a one-liner. But, you know, it kind of happened out of the corner of your eye. So you were almost not quite convinced you were seeing what you were seeing. Yeah.
You know, I think we simply have to stop and give people a chance to ask some questions, and then if there's another minute, we'll look at one of the pavilions we particularly liked.
Yeah. Over here and then back there. Here first.
Thank you. let's see, is biennially every even number year or every odd number of years?
Odd.
Every odd number year.
Okay. And when is the time since open and when is the best time to go?
That's a really hard question. Because if you go at the very beginning, it can be a little crowded and hot because it's June. It's open from June to November. Going in November, Venice is fantastic in November. The only problem is that all of the videos, anything that requires a plug will be broken. So the danger of going at the end is that all you'll see is the sculpture and the painting because everything else will be broken. It's a real problem. But it's almost worth it to get to Venice in November. You could go to Venice in November, pretend you've seen the Biennale, and just enjoy the city in November. It's open, I think, 10 to 6.
Yeah, I think.
Every day, most days.
And Mondays and Tuesdays, I mean, if you're really planning a trip, Mondays and Tuesdays, some of the venues are closed, so you need to kind of take that into account.
When is it open in June?
It opens at the beginning, very beginning of June. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it is not, here's something important for all you power players here. I think it's a waste to go at the very beginning. I really think it's a waste to go, that is, to the special highfalutin opening. If I didn't have to, I'd go 2 weeks later, because it's such a zoo. And we stayed one day later than usual. We stayed for the first day the public's allowed in. It was empty.
Yeah.
You go from having 6,000 people in one pavilion or whatever, to it being empty on the first day the public's allowed in, which is tragic, if you ask me.
Yeah.
But I definitely would not go for the deluxe opening.
Because you have to wait in line. And you might not get to see some of the things you want to see. So there's a question back there.
Let's get the microphone.
I don't think I need the microphone. I just wanted to ask about the American Pavilion, Bruce Nauman.
Bruce Nauman is one of the great, great, great artists, I think, of the last God knows how many years. Do we need to see Bruce Nauman again? There were pieces I'd seen before. The American Pavilion is such a pleasant, tidy, neoclassical building that it sort of turned Bruce Nauman into a pleasant, tidy artist, which is weird. I don't know if you agree with me. It tamed him. His new work, it was in this pavilion, but then two universities were also showing work by him.
Which I didn't get to see.
A lot of people didn't get to it because it took time to get to it. They were good new works. He doesn't do a lot of really bad work, but I didn't think it was Bruce Nauman at his best. Having said which, you forget how much less people in Europe might have seen Bruce Nauman. There were huge lineups to get in to see the work. So there was clearly a hunger for Bruce Nauman there that we might not completely share.
Yeah, but I mean, I would say that if you want a nice concentrated dose of Bruce Nauman, you should go to the Art Institute of Chicago and check out the new wing, because there's actually a nice kind of compilation of the neon work and video that actually I think makes Bruce Nauman a little bit like grittier than these examples.
Here's a sort of naughty thought real quick. It's very strange that the United States now has a tradition, not entirely, but a strong tradition of showing very senior artists who they know will make us look good. The other countries that do that tend to be very small countries that are insecure. Greece does that. Who else was doing that? A bunch of countries were doing that. Whereas other countries, Canada, for instance, Britain, are showing the most interesting, exciting artists that they've got. So it seems strange that the United States has got this semi-tradition of showing fairly safe old masters now.
Yeah, I mean, one could sort of argue actually how far back that goes. I mean, Fred Wilson, Robert Gober, I think these were all...
Gober's on the edge between the two categories.
Yeah, but in 2001, maybe less so on the edge. They're definitely with Ruscha, I mean, sort of this looking at fairly established figures, I think is true. Yeah.
I wonder, it seems like this Biennale experience of seeing art is, to hear you describe it, it's very much about the experience of the slog itself. I mean, you're talking about moments of respite and the grand gestures that you remember out of 500,000 square feet of exhibition. And there is much more to art than just sort of that aha moment of reader or a great visual that you did manage to remember a week later. But at the same time, you have artists like Spencer Fincher, who I think are very superficial, who you give the benefit of the doubt to. And you have somebody like Liam Gillick, who you write off with a snide comment about a cat, who actually has an incredibly deep practice in a whole bunch that you could read up on, but you choose not to. So I'm trying to figure out how do you how you decide what is your memorable superficial experience and separate that from your forgettable one?
That's a hugely difficult question. The snide comment about Liam Gillick was, in this room, not really. In person, I spent long with it, and I'm an admirer.
Sarah Singapore and other people who has an incredibly, a deep interest in the 60s, it was probably maybe why I put alongside Mona Clark. But yet, it was just not to say as a playground.
Well, I think artists, good artists, can do bad work, and I think the Saraceno work was simply a bad work. But that's a problem. If the work is being shown in that context, there's no way around it. If work actually, it's either a fault of the curator or the artist to show work in a context where it can't be appreciated. I don't know what the answer is. I spent 6 days and I wish I could have spent longer. Most people, the average I think is 2 days. And I knew substantial art world people who did it all in a day. I don't know what they did, but they did something in a day.
I wouldn't say it's a mistake of the artist or the curator to sort of develop this or participate. If you're an artist, what I think the benefit of the Biennale is it's an opportunity to see a lot all at once. And no, it's not a great place to engage with things in depth. But then when you walk away from it, the things that linger, that you want to investigate further, are that's the benefit of going there to have those moments.
You will notice that we could tell the superficial things we were enjoying. So there is a moment, for instance, with Guyton Walker, where we say, oh, wait a minute, this departs from that. This, even though I don't have time to go back to it, I'd be interested in it. We haven't talked about the pavilions. That's why I like the pavilions. Because they, if you're sucked into one of them, you're likely to stay for a few hours and then say, oh my God, I can't believe I spent 2 hours there. Now I'm going to have to slight everything else. So the pavilions are kind of antidote, I think.
Yes. I think over there first and then back down.
You used the term window in process.
I think she used that, window into process.
Window into process? Well, I feel that, for instance, with the Guyton Walker piece, but also with several other pieces in the show, that kind of what the artists are exploring is the process of making art itself. They're trying to give you a sense of what it feels like to be in the studio and to sort of have the challenge of making something meaningful, to manipulate materials in some way that's aesthetic or not aesthetic, depending on sort of their practice. And for me, there were moments in the show, and I think it plays to the theme of making worlds, and if you consider the studio a world, where you had those insights into the artistic process. Does that answer the question?
I would go so far as to say that the Guyton Walker piece wasn't just a window, it was about the whole notion of windows, and maybe even poking fun at it in a way, because it's pseudo-process. It's not really a studio, it's a sort of simulation of a studio. So there was a kind of interesting mise en abîme, a kind of endless recession as you try to figure it out.
Yeah. There's a question here.
You went through the slides relatively quickly, but I don't remember seeing any painting. Is there any painting in there?
Well, there were...
Thank God.
There were some paintings in the
Italian,
in the
bad Italian pavilion, San Giorgio.
Oh no, I was actually thinking of this Italian pavilion.
But the old what's it called? The exhibition
palace. I mean, one of the things that was interesting to me was to see. For me, it played out more in terms of how little figuration there was. But I was struck by these are artists whose work I really didn't know before I went to Venice this time around, but Pietro Roccaslava, if I'm saying that right, and Alessandro Pozzoli. The Roccaslava really had a strong affinity to Bacon's work, but a very young artist. So he would be someone that I'll be keeping my eye on. But yeah, there wasn't a whole lot of painting.
I think if there was any, were there even the old masterish kind of paintings? There was a Butai piece which consisted of three blank canvases that we were in theory invited to write on, but we were given absolutely no tools for painting on.
Painting was very present in the Pinot collection, which we haven't touched on at all, but Francois Pinot's collection now has two venues in Venice, the Palazzo Grassi and the Punta della Dogana. And for instance, what I found were magnificent Sigmar Polka paintings from 2007, the Rob Stor Biennial, had sort of been acquired and moved en masse to the Punta della Dogana.
It is true there was amazingly little painting of any kind, though there were a million references to painting. I mean, especially in the earlier work, in all the work, in fact. Yeah. Painting was definitely the absent other, which was interesting. You could write about that. If one had an occasion to write about Venice.
I have a question. Can you speak more about this idea of the changing importance of national identity and specific countries' pavilions? Particularly interested with this idea of Germany selecting an Irish artist, sort of see it as someone who's born in another country, who comes to the U.S., lives there, trains there, and then goes back to run for their track team in the Olympics, you know, that sort of thing.
Yeah, it's the same phenomenon. I hate the national identity in the Olympics, and I'm uncomfortable with it here. There were examples, though, where I thought it was very interesting. The United Arab Emirates Pavilion, I don't think it was something that people were really waiting to see with bated breath, turned out to be a very interesting discussion of the notion of national identity, national support for the arts, tourism, really quite a complex, interesting treatment of that material.
It was fascinating, but was it aesthetic or was it kind of sociological? I mean, my experience of that pavilion was not so much an encounter with artworks of a particular place in the world, but with sort of an examination, a sociological examination of that place.
Yeah, it was definitely that. Well, there were big photographs. It was sort of funny. One of the United Arab Emirates, I think Dubai, is famous for having the only million-star hotel in the world. What is it, 7 stars or whatever? So this guy instead, this photographer instead, took pictures of all the 1-star hotels in Dubai, the places where you're guaranteed to get bed bugs, just guaranteed. And it was a lovely series of photographs of these very modest, but really trim hotels where people are trying to keep it together. So there was that.
Yeah.
But that was a really complex pavilion that one didn't have time to absorb. But you thought, well, there's really something going on here. This is something really poking fun at the country that had sponsored it, but doing it so subtly that the powers that be couldn't have complained, right? By so much seeming to present the glories of Dubai and United Arab Emirates, you assumed it was ironic, but no one could say, wait a minute, are you making fun?
Yeah.
It's really, I thought, a subtle way.
Subtle and interesting, but it definitely turns this idea of nationalism or national representation on its head.
And it could have been done, of course, by someone not from this country just as easily.
Right. And it could have, I mean, that kind of, let's call it universal irony, mm-hmm. could have manifested itself in any of the pavilions, really. I mean, it's that discourse, it's that language that that is sort of global in its scope, but nevertheless belonging to a certain group of people.
Yeah, and I do think that certain countries, I mean, United Arab Emirates have a real identity issue even more than every other country in the world. So there was, I thought, a particular relevance to using that device, that strategy.
Yeah. Unfortunately, we
there's
don't.
There's not much to show because it's basically a bunch of text panels. I mean, it's
architectural models.
It was made to look like a display at a very bad trade fair for tourism or something. So it was not visual except for those photographs that I mentioned. More questions?
Yes, there's one back.
Well, you could go real utopian, and say that all of these countries that were as much invested in national identity and nationalist politics as we ever have been, if not worse than before, except that the art world is actually maybe an example of a slightly less nationalist arena. The art world that we're talking about, this tiny, tiny little world of navel-gazing, you know, makers and lookers at art.
And buyers.
And buyers.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny because, of course, the market has collapsed within the time that I assume these pavilions were being put together. And it is amazing that there are so many participants given sort of the economy. But I think you also have to sort of put that question out there. I mean, if the art world is a very commodified world, if it's an important sort of market, then perhaps one of the incentives for having a pavilion is to sort of participate in that economy.
I mean, the downside, of course, of doing away with nationalist identity is you get pan-global capitalism. So it's hard to know if it's a good sign or a bad sign that the art world has rejected national identities as fixed notions. Any other questions or,
right here.
Sorry.
Yeah.
I sometimes like to think of the art world as a reflection, a snapshot of human culture and its nuanced change and transformations. And, you know, in our world of post-Abu Ghraib and Iraq, Afghanistan, what happened to the world economy, kind of an age of kind of a rise of fear globally, how is this
That's a really good question. Do you want to go first? Or?
Principle, maybe an unprincipled principle. I reject the notion that art reflects the times it's made in. I think it's just way too easy a notion. It's like saying that Venetian art looks the way it does because it comes from Venetian air and light. I don't see that art necessarily does that. The problem is it's always easy to claim it does because you can find similarities between any two things. So once you have a work of art made in a particular period, you can always make the link. That's the way human minds work. So I'm always uncomfortable with imagining that that's going to be the case.
I disagree. But go ahead. You can finish your thought.
But of course, the other thing is once we've established that that's the norm, then it becomes something that artists do explicitly, and that's a different story.
I mean, I have the completely opposite point of view that art can't help but be a sort of reflection of the moment in time that it's created and sort of the ideas that are out there in the culture and the dialogue that happens between artists. And, you know, I do think it's, but that being said, I think it is very hard to sort of generalize when you've just seen, you know, 200 or 300 artists' work that there are any main currents. But that being said, I do think that there was a more modest scale to some of the works. And one thing that we haven't discussed is that I did feel that there was a motif or a trend where artists were actually looking at the phenomenon of collecting. It emerged in a couple of pavilions in very significant ways. It's almost as if the epoch of the great sort of like rabid collecting might have an end point, or at least might be transitioning into something else, and artists are trying to kind of make sense of that because it's been such a symbiotic relationship over the past 5-6 years.
This event has been on, I did feel, for reasons I can't quite figure out, less like an art fair than sometimes it does. There wasn't that frenzy, it felt more coherent. There was less glitzy, superficial work that just felt a little more low-key.
Low-key, yeah.
You know, which I really enjoyed. Maybe this should be our last question, or we could take one more afterwards.
I was just wondering if we could see more of the country pavilions, if you had a chance.
The national pavilions. Do we have some images of national pavilions?
Yeah, we
can
do this
very
quickly.
The problem with national pavilions is there are now 77 of them, so it's very hard to represent them.
Okay.
And they range from fantastic to weak.
Okay, so we don't really have an image that works for Steve McQueen.
Steve McQueen was a slightly disappointing film, which was also very poignant, shot in the Giardini in the drippy winter, recording various sort of iffy assignations, which I think were real. It was kind of documentary, but showing just how grim this space is when the Biennale is not on.
But also, I mean, interestingly, in 2007, McQueen had a piece in the group show that was a really, I felt, a very incredible film about mining, the exploitation involved in sort of mining a particular mineral in the Democratic Republic of Congo. And this year he produces a film that's sort of about sort of the romance of Venice.
About the romance of Venice is the most courageous thing.
That's an interesting thing to think about, those two points, 2007 versus 2009, and those two different kinds of films.
This was what we both think is one of the more interesting things. They set up the Danish and the Nordic pavilions, which are two adjoining pavilions, as pseudo-collectors' houses, and got all sorts of, a dozen artists at least, to put works into the house, into the houses, so there's a pseudo-Frank Stella there.
By Sturtevant.
Yeah, by Sturtevant. And then the actual curators, can you pronounce the name for me? I always get it right. Elmgreen and Dragset, who organized this whole thing, did the sort of interior decor, all sorts of very strange things presented as though, and here's the collector, this is why this house may have to be sold now. And there's a whole gay theme in it. He was sort of a gay fabulous guy who collects mid-century modern furniture. So it was this funny mix of this was not, that piece wasn't in the show when I saw it, The Young Man.
Yeah.
But it was quite interesting. One of the things there was a entertainment well, I guess you could call it, that was showing 1970s porn, and that was actually a piece by an artist that was quite interesting, this collection of classic 1970s gay porn.
But, I mean, what was interesting about this is there were two separate pavilions and sort of two fictional collectors. So, you know, there was sort of this collector who ended up in the pool. But in this house, if you will, the story was about a couple of collectors who were divorcing, and that's why everything's kind of falling apart and split in half.
Cute, I thought that. This one was cute, and the whole project risked falling over into the wildly cute and stylish. I mean, it's all very well to make fun of mid-century modern, but I bet 92% of the artists displaying in this place own exactly those pieces in their apartments. So there was a strange, I was a little nervous about having one's Eames chair and eating it too.
Oops, now I'm going really fast. And we already talked about that. Yeah. There, let's...
This was, I think, for both of us, one of our favorite pieces.
Yeah.
You go ahead, I'm sorry.
Well, in this scenario, what happened is that the garden actually continued into the pavilion. So she walked into the building, the plants that grow in the Giardini were planted in the structure. It's just a continuity of those two spaces.
So you didn't, a lot of people just walked through, they didn't realize they'd gone into a pavilion at all because they were so absorbed in the texture of the gravels identical, the plantings. So they just walked right through as though they had just walked. It was actually a really lyrical little piece. Was it a one-liner?
Maybe it was. I don't know. I mean, it definitely, a word that kept coming to me in relationship to the things that I remembered most about Venice was the word relief. And walking into that space provided a sense of relief. Provided something different from what I had been seeing all around me, and kind of a moment of pause and reflection. But I found myself sort of being more in tune with kind of my own thoughts than maybe what the artist was attempting, or sort of what I was looking at around me. And I haven't quite teased out, you know, how profound I felt the artwork was in itself, or just how profound that moment of experiencing something different was.
But that's the artwork, of course, in itself. There's a painting if you want to.
Photograph.
No, I thought they
aren't
were
they?
Photographs have been painted.
Oh, maybe.
I think that they're photorealist paintings, but they're of a woman wearing fake sagging breasts dancing. That's the state of painting today.
These are not
just
good.
Digging myself deeper. Now at this point I'm so deep I might as well just keep going. I like painting actually.
So Fiona Tan videos, which are hard to talk about. Here's some more painting. The Austrian Pavilion, which was a group show curated by the artist Valley Export. And it included paintings by Elka Christofek that are very sort of in your face, you know, presenting the male body in an objectified, sexualized way. Friends.
This was... not the most moving thing I'd ever been in.
Yeah.
I spent a long time, I hope the curator's not here, but I made the mistake of getting a curatorial tour, which involved an hour in this one space with these silver cages and this black flag blowing in the breeze. It was long. I thought this was kind of nice.
Mad Max Redux. Yeah.
So of all the Australians, there's a nicer one where he's a motorcyclist in a black leather jacket who comes across a dead kangaroo. And there's this kind of tender moment with the dead kangaroo.
We talked a little bit about this, but...
Lewis. Yeah, it's too complicated to talk about. Video. Polish woman, Polish dealer who saw this hated it. This is, you know, Poland's most famous artist. It was a little coy and sentimental, maybe.
Yeah, I mean, maybe some of you experienced a similar installation at Gallery Lalong a couple of years ago, and I think when I first had that experience, what happens is you listen to sound that headphones that sort of clue you into these kinds of conversations that are supposedly going on between the people that you see in these windows. And the first time I experienced this piece, it was a little mysterious, and I was kind of intrigued to hear the stories. It was harder to sort of relate to the piece in the setting of the Biennale when you're moving quickly, and you know, you want to kind of get it right away.
That's a problem. I mean, yeah, that's a problem. I think we should probably finish up in Romania. Was one of the best pavilions for me for different reasons than you liked it.
Yeah. I mean, again, maybe it was this idea of relief, but it was really, I thought this roof, this living roof was quite beautiful.
This little maze of little videos, and then at the end you got to climb a staircase and see this absurd little interior garden perched on top of the video rooms. But some of the videos were pretty in your face. I thought there was a weird, weird video of dog puppets. And I can't possibly, I know, it's just, they're all these ridiculously scary dog puppets discussing ways in which one could torture someone. It was really over the top, I thought.
Yeah, but I don't do puppets.
She doesn't do puppets. So she's got very narrow perimeters.
Chilly.
I mean, I don't do painting, you don't do puppets.
So, I mean, and this is, I think, one of the, for me, it was one of the more profound pavilions, the Mexican pavilion, with a sort of artwork by Teresa Margolis that was activated at different moments during the course of the Biennale. But she is an artist whose studio, in a way, is the morgue, and she collected water that was used to cleanse victims that had been killed as a result of drug-related violence, and used that water to enact a performance where she was cleansing the floors with it. I thought it was quite profound.
I think maybe we should end now, but that's an interesting, this just to make
on a happy note.
Yeah. This is actually proves my point about needing 10 days. I mean, I spent a long time trying to do Venice, and I missed what turned out to be a really interesting piece. Yeah. And that can happen so easily. I mean, one of my favorite pieces 2 years ago was the Cypress Pavilion. If anyone had said, are you planning to make a beeline to the Cypress Pavilion, I would have said no. So it really is worth going everywhere, because you never know what's going to be good. And it's never, I mean, you know, Mark Lewis and Steve McQueen, two artists I really admire, turned out not to be the most interesting. I would not have made a beeline to the Romanian pavilion by any means.
Yeah.
So it's really worth spending every bit of time you can get off work.
Yeah, it's a bit of a treasure hunt.
Yeah. But there are treasures. Thanks very much.
Thank you.